Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at FoleyTom, and the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. We're going to be speaking today with Dr. Brian Jack, Professor of Family Medicine. He's from the Boston University School of Medicine and Boston Medical Center. He is a recipient of many distinguished awards, to name a few, the Peter Drucker Award for Nonprofit Innovation, the CDC Partner in Public Health Innovation Award. He developed the Re-Engineered Discharge, RED, program used around the world. His article describing RED is listed in the book of 50 studies every physician should know. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you today.
Awesome. So, Doctor, we spoke last time about a number of different things on the reimagining the delivery of care. Today, I wanted to focus a little bit about the journey of that patient and as they, too, reimagine how care is delivered and supports them. So it's just tying a couple of things together. Last time, and with Dr. John Woodson, a previous guest as well, we talked about the digitally transforming the post-COVID healthcare, this vision of how we should transform. Remind our guests a little bit about what that vision is.
Sure, Tom. So much of moving healthcare forward relies on a digital health strategy, like in other sectors of the economy. And that the COVID crisis really gave us an opportunity to, reflect on the opportunities that are available to sort of restructure our health system and move it forward. For example, in areas, the vaccine distribution efforts would have been improved if we had had some digitalization of our systems. And pre-existing digitally connected and coordinated networks would have improved both the testing and the vaccine efforts. And the availability of data, the interoperability of data, and ultimately the digitalization of patient registries at the primary care level or the health system level that's interoperable with other systems would have been a big advance for us. And for example, the digital health patient registries at a health system level would allow a more optimal population health response. In other words, reaching out to patient populations that otherwise aren't accessing care to improve their health. And as we move from our fee-for-service structure to a more value-based care, meaning payment for groups of patients, populations of patients that are predefined, caring for those people who come to see us, we do a good job with, but then reaching out to those that don't because we are now responsible for them, to keep them healthier, to keep them out of the hospital is incentivized then by these new value-based fee structures, which is essential for improved health of the nation, in my view. And that, all of these things, are leading towards the operationalized units of mostly based in primary care of digital support around team-based care within the patient-centered medical home and interactive platforms, behavioral health integration, care of complex and high-cost patients, which is essential in these new schemes, and expansion of services and then monitoring of key quality and safety metrics. So there's a lot on our plate, and a lot of it is, connected to the ultimate goal of, better health for the nation and universal coverage for the nation. And those, of course, are related as well.
Interesting. Very interesting. So we talk about value-based care, but the way I interpret much of what you said was we're really also shifting the focus towards wellness. If we shift the focus towards wellness, not that we're going to forget about the management of chronic conditions, but the market ultimately has to focus on both, right? While a lot of our dollars are spent on the management of chronic conditions, a majority of our dollars are spent on managing chronic conditions. It's really, if we can re-engineer and reimagine the delivery of care to focus on the wellness side, get great more emphasis on there, we won't have that curve as they get older. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Sure. Yeah, the more that we can to reach out at the population health level to improve the health education, the patient preparation, the screening, the monitoring of healthy people, but also people with chronic diseases in terms of digital platforms for example, diabetes, for depression, for asthma, for a whole variety of things where there's ample evidence in all those areas to show that these digitalized health platforms can improve the overall monitoring of the patient and be sure that all the patients who need to be monitored are monitored. So it's really both better quality for those that are currently kind of in the system and also engaging those who are currently not in the system in monitoring programs of various kinds. And there's lots of work being done, Tom, in all these areas, in various specific disease platforms and lots of advances that are really ready for prime time, it seems.
Interesting. So, it's important here that the patient journey be a consideration. It's not just about what the health system wants to do. It's really about, the journey of the patient that are all obviously in different stages based on age and conditions and chronic management and things of that nature. So, we previously had talked about a five-step journey: a virtual interaction, high acuity encounter, remote screening and monitoring, the virtual care vision, and the maximizing population wellness, which we touched on a bit. And so let's talk about each one of those steps, if you will. Tell me a little bit about the virtual interaction and how might that differ from a brick and mortar interaction?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I think you and I and others at the Institute for Health Systems Innovation and Policy were presenting a webinar, and that we, as in the course of our conversations, sort of conceptualized, sort of a stepwise process. And I think there's some value to that. And then we can go through each of those steps today. Of course, each of the steps, there's overlap between and among them. But I think that going from step one to step five in one giant leap is probably not going to happen. That this is going to be somewhat of an incremental process over time, so that the steps have a lot of, I think they can be useful to think about, what are the major sort of milestones or landmarks, or what are the, when you move from one to the next, what is it that we're thinking about doing, so that we can kind of prepare for how those things need to be done, both in terms of the infrastructure necessary to do it, but also in terms of the workflows and all the things that need to be done on the clinical side to make that happen. So as we think through as we move through the steps, what is it that we need to do to get there? And sometimes it's, is identifying and developing and testing the various technologies. But the bigger part, in my view, is changing the culture of the health system in a way that can, where implementation of new innovations can happen. Because healthcare, like other sectors, and maybe more so, that the culture of health and sort of the routines that people get into are hard to change.
Yeah.
So thinking through the steps could help us quite a lot in terms of sort of the implementation once the technologies are really ready to go.
Interesting. So, go ahead, doctor, you had more?
Yeah, so in terms of the first step, as we've talked about, Tom, is really the simple, interaction, either telephonic or video interaction. And that, those technologies have moved remarkably forward. Even for step one, the technologies have been available for quite a long time, of course. but until COVID, not used so much. And that the, you know, the policies around simple telephonic or video visits that were holding us back had to do with, again, workflows in the clinical environment, you know, documentation systems, the sort of the hardware, video hardware necessary and how to access it, various electronic health record modifications. Now practice policies were modified, lots of clinical and staff training about how to do these new workflows. Billing codes needed to be created, patient safety and quality metrics and monitoring needed to be done. And all these things were kind of holding it back previously. And when COVID came, it's really true that necessity is the mother of invention. We had to do it and things moved very rapidly to where we are currently. So, and that's good to see that we, you know, how these things can move forward and what the incentives are to move things forward. But we've come a long way in terms of video interactions and still at, you know, major hospitals, a large percent of the visits now as we come out the other side of COVID are still being done virtually. And it's everybody's expectation that we are not going to move backwards on that after COVID, because people realize that patients like it. Patients like the convenience. You can do, you know, for the right kind of presenting complaint from the patient, for the right diagnosis, video visits are as good as in-person visits. Of course, the challenge is to identify for which kinds of problems are these visits as good, and for which ones are there challenges, and to help to maximize the number of video visits that can happen. But people like it, providers like it, and so they're not going to go anywhere. And that's moved us, you know, onto the starting line, which is step one.
Yeah. So I misspoke earlier on the five steps. So let me just correct myself. There was I misread the slide, frankly. Virtual interaction, higher acuity encounter, which we'll talk about next, remote screening and monitoring. The step that I got in an error was I said virtual care vision. I should have said manage consumer wellness and journey. And then the last step is maximize population wellness. So doctor, taking what you previously said about the virtual interaction, we see now with COVID, or at least in the US, we see COVID mitigating itself, not that it's gone away, but it's mitigating itself, and people are starting to open up again. And at the same time, we see the number of virtual encounters starting to decline. Some suggest that telehealth was nice. It helped us during COVID, but you know, we're going back to normal, right? That change, overall change of the fabric and how you deliver care, there's a tough brick wall to break. So as we go from virtual interaction to higher acuity encounters, talk to us a little bit about how you see the continued migration to adding virtual care into the delivery of care model, and the next step in the journey about higher acuity encounter.
Yeah, it's a good question, Tom, about, you know, where do we go from here in terms of remote, you know, video visits, and what is sort of the natural evolution of the technologies and the workflows within clinical care. So it's, you know, it is true that telehealth visits accounted for 35% of primary care encounters during the height of the pandemic. But it's also true that primary care visits decreased by 20%. So it did not replace all the visits that would have happened previously. So the question is, why is that? And when you think about it, Tom, how is it? And all this was done on the fly at the time. But how is it that you schedule a video visit versus an in-person visit? And I remember those days a year ago, you know, trying to think through, you know, how do we make those decisions? You know? But a lot of it comes down to the day-to-day work, and the patient will call, and the nurse assigned to triaging, you know, phone calls talks to the patient, and then makes some decision based upon various criteria that have evolved quite a lot since those early days about who needs an in-person visit versus those that don't, right? And a lot of that has to do with is a physical examination necessary? And is there something about the in-person encounter that will add information and data that is necessary to do, you know, the right thing at the time of the visit? And that the nurse makes that decision and assigns them to either video or in-person. And of course, the clinicians can, you know, change that and you know, schedule for an in-person visit and various things like that. But that the need for in-person visits is still there. And the question is, why is that? So I think as we move into higher acuity visits, so step two and three, the how do we overcome some of the barriers to digital visits using technologies? So how can we do physical examinations using telehealth? It was come down to. So there are a variety of hardwares that are available right now that could be done, could be used for the more higher acuity visits, such as vital sign monitors of various kinds. And we've had conversations in the past about blood pressure monitoring, using systems like sphygmomanometers where they have the big cuff and all that is very difficult for a lot of elderly people to do. So some simpler ways to monitor vital signs, particularly blood pressure, is a key one. And then there are some new innovative things like video laryngoscopes to assist with the intubation of severely ill COVID patients had been developed previously, but was then used during the COVID crisis in a variety of different ways. And then things like digital stethoscopes, so you can listen to heart sounds sitting in your office remotely from the patient. Is that technology available? Yeah, it is. We could be doing that now. And that seems to me to be the next phase of video digital health visits.
Doctor, I have to pause you for a second. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Virtual Shift. I'm your host, Tom Foley, and we're speaking with Dr. Brian Jack from the Boston University of Medicine and Boston Medical Center. We're speaking about the patient's journey. Doctor, we have about 12 minutes left, and I want to cover the other three steps of the journey, remote screening and monitoring. Tell us a little bit more about how when you get from virtual interaction to high acuity encounter, remote screening and monitoring.
Yeah, so there are a variety of digital platforms being built now and used now around, for example, photography of the retina used in ophthalmology. So all diabetic patients, all hypertensive patients need to have retinal exams. So looking at the back of your eye, looking for pathology. To screen, and if there are findings related to the diseases in the back of the eye, then treatments can be instituted to prevent blindness. So it's a very important, fantastic opportunity. But of course, with video visits, that's not possible. But more and more, there are remote ways of screening for that sort of activity. Another example is high-resolution cameras to aid in teledermatology. There's a lot of reports about the use of video visits in dermatology, and high resolution cameras are more and more being used to do that. Also, things like monitors built into cell phones to monitor depressive symptoms or asthma symptoms or heart rate and a whole long variety of different kinds of things that are being tested actively now that would allow us then to monitor the patient at home and to visit them virtually without the need for these monitoring devices in the office, for example. So a lot of it is moving a lot of these devices from the office, from the hospital to the home to be delivered virtually. There's also a lot of discussions now and articles that are coming out about how to train the future workforce, that is the young doctors, the residents who are in training, about how to do telehealth exams. Now, you know, 2 years ago, no one talked about that at all. But now we need to learn, you know, since they are now responsible for doing telehealth visits, how do we train them to do that? And what are the protocols and procedures for telehealth exams? And there are now fellowships that are being developed around telehealth. So people finish residency programs and are doing fellowships to be experts in the delivery of telehealth services. So there's a lot of action, and it's moving very rapidly, Tom.
Interesting. So if tying in some of the previous steps in the journey, if I am involved in remote screening and monitoring, and back to a high acuity encounter, I might have a blood pressure cuff. It might be issued from my payer, or I've purchased it myself. But the bottom line is, I have I might have a few medical devices at home that can stream video from an otoscope or a camera. It could stream audio from a stethoscope. It could capture data from my blood pressure cuff. And you as a doctor can see that all in real time. Mm-hmm. So that can happen in a high acuity encounter. Those same devices are used in a remote screening and monitoring, where the doctor, I might not be involved in a video visit, but those same devices are used to capture the data and stream information to the, I'll just call it the data, clinical data repository. Some might refer to that as a EHR. And so that the data is always, is not lost, if you will, relative to that that overall monitoring. I would imagine a combination of that leads into the managed consumer wellness journey, both from a consumer's perspective and the care team's participation in that journey. Thoughts?
No, I think that's right. So, yeah. So we start with video visits and then move to, you know, higher acuity visits and then remote screening and monitoring. And then it seems like, you know, the next sort of natural evolution of these technology will be what we're calling care anywhere, which is really the sort of the interoperability of all these systems working together as a team, you know, as part of the team. And so it would be, you know, the health ecosystem components being connected together in a highly interoperative way, including a lot of these monitoring systems in the home. And, you know, people talk about, you know, security and that sort of thing, but, you know, that we, you know, it's like the banking system. You know, a few years ago, none of us would want to, you know, put all of our finances online, but now who would ever think about going to the bank, you know? Yeah. And the same thing can be done for health data, but we, for a variety of reasons, have not moved in that direction.
So even with TEFCA and interoperability push, the payer, the provider, the consumer still have a long journey in and of itself on how to share data to maximize their respective participation in the path to wellness. Fair point.
I think that's right. And I think maybe justifiably so, because this is their own personal health data and a lot of personal information, that sort of thing. But we can get there, and that the, you know, the safety of the data, you know, has to be primary.
So the last step, if you will, in the journey, and we only have a couple of minutes left here, mm-hmm. maximize population wellness. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, once we sort of put the interoperable systems and put all the pieces of the puzzle together, then it's a matter of what do we do with it all? And that there's a lot of exciting things happening relative, you know, to what we've talked about previously, which is the concept of population health. So having these digital patient registries is essential in order to know who the patients are, so that we can reach out to them rather than waiting for them to come to see us in the office, that we know who our defined population is and can deliver the health services and the health education necessary for their particular clinical situation sort of proactively. And that that tied to the incentives around value-based care and health reform related to free payment for services balanced with quality and safety will allow us to really deliver the services that we've talked about up till now at the population health level, that is to everybody, not just those that come to see us with particular clinical problems. Another area moving forward, once we put these systems all together, is the idea of advanced analytics, artificial intelligence, and moving towards personalized precision medicine, which is on the horizon, I would say, but lots of work being done in those areas so that in the future, that big data then could be used to not tell you what are the protocols, procedures, best recommendations for this clinical condition, but what is the best way forward for you as an individual based upon not only population data, but individual data around your past medical history, and then even ultimately moving towards human genomics, including data from all the cells of our body in terms of prediction of disease states in the future. So that's looking towards the future. But once we have all these pieces together in terms of putting the puzzle together, all these things not only are possible, but actively worked on currently.
Very good. Well, that's all the time that we have today, Doctor. Great talking to you, as always. I want to thank you once again for your participation, and we'll be sure to have you on in a future session. I would like to thank the show sponsors, both HP and Intel. HP Engage long lifecycle products provide the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. As well, Intel would like you to know we're going above and beyond together with new standards for business with the latest Intel vPro processors, delivering what IT needs for performance, security, remote manageability, and stability. And be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.